This episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is brought to you by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 51. Who is a Sherlockian?
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
And we are so glad that you did come and decide to join us this time for I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes devotees. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Wolder.
And together we are reunited and we feel so good bringing you our own rantings of what's going on in the world of Sherlock Holmes and our own, I guess one could say, unique perspective on all things Sherlockian.
Yeah.
It's if you're catching up on episodes, if you happen to be listening to us one after the other in just a marathon mode, you may not have noticed the gap in our publication. But for those listeners who, God help them, are following along closely, it's been a few months actually since we've been on the air, and we do apologize for that. But that's what happens when life gets in the way.
Yes.
But, Bert, you're back and with us?
I'm back, and you seem to be back. You know, working for a living is a great distraction.
It really is. We need to stop.
Yeah, we do. You go first. You start first.
I would love to, but until we get, major success and sponsorships out of this show, I don't think we can quit our day jobs.
You mean the movie rights have not yet sold?
No, primarily because the Conan Doyle estate has been asking too much out of us.
Les Klinger will fix that for us.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because that is one of the topics that we'd like to discuss in today's show. There have been a lot of things going on in the world of Sherlock Holmes, particularly from a, I won't just say a legal perspective, because it's more than that, but it's almost been like a mini soap opera over the course of the last few months, the beginning of 2013. It's been a lot of hubbub, a lot of kerfuffles going on in the online space. And I suppose the legal one is a great one to start with. So would you care to recap it for us?
Well, the Conan Doyle estate has been very active over the last, I can't actually date it in terms of the length.
It's been at least 10 years or so, if not more.
10 years, but I was thinking longer because, of course, regardless of how long it is, the Conan Doyle estate's been very active with a particular interpretation of copyright law, which suggests that although the majority of the cases of Sherlock Holmes are now in the public domain under copyright law, nonetheless, there is a selection of stories, I believe those that are constituted in the casebook, that do still have some copyright protection. And the position of the estate has been that the characters of Holmes and Watson are not fully formed without looking at the entirety of the corpus. And therefore, they have requested, and in most cases, I believe, been successful in receiving some sort of remuneration from those people who wish to use the characters in various forms. So that is a crisp summary, I think. And Les Klinger, who, as our listeners know, the Sherlockians know, is very active in the Sherlockian world, including the publishing, has over the years participated, or at least created Sherlockian works that have been subject to such fees. I believe in all cases paid by his publishers, but perhaps in some cases paid by Les himself, I don't know, in terms of a portion of proceeds or other fees going to the estate to permit uninterrupted or uninterfered with publication. The general approach, I think, of the estate has been that we will discourage such publication and distribution without our rights being recognized. And this beavered along in an uninterrupted fashion until Les's most recent publishing effort, in which such remuneration was requested from the estate. And Les's publisher, as I believe, made it clear to him that they were not willing to proceed with the book until this particular issue is resolved. Well, Les, as you may or may not know, is also a very experienced attorney, and said to himself at this point, enough is enough, and enlisted the assistance of a Chicago-based law firm to challenge the assertion by the estate that they had such rights. And that is the work that's now progressing through the fantasy world of the American legal system.
So it's fascinating... It's a fascinating case to watch because, like most legal cases that make it this far, it's not that clear cut. I think those that side with Les see it from almost from a moral perspective that you know it's almost unconscionable for the estate to be, and in this case they were outright threatening to withhold publication on sites like Amazon and Barnes & Noble with this character that's been in the public, I won't say domain, that's a legal term, but in the public's consciousness for over 100 years. And then again, you know, to those that take up the side of the Conan Doyle estate, it is a little bit sticky because there are still 10 or so stories that are left in copyright. And, you know, for those that are defending the heirs of creators, and I know Walt Disney was part of this discussion some years ago, this is their bread and butter. And simply erasing that revenue stream because of whether one considers it capriciousness or an inaccurate legal assessment is a little dangerous as well. So,
well, and the other, yeah, that's right. And the other thing that makes it particularly poignant is that the irregulars have a long history of essentially being on the side of the author. Rex Stout was a great campaigner. You know, as most of our listeners probably know, Rex Stout was an early irregular and also the author of the Nero Wolfe stories, Nero Wolfe and Archie Goodwin. And Rex Stout, I can't remember what Rex's, he wasn't president of the Authors League, but I don't remember. He did serve as the head of at least one major institution that represented the rights of authors. And in the 1970s campaigned for, as I recall, an extension of copyright law. And at the time, I think his efforts were around getting copyright law to the point where the copyright would extend to the life of the author plus 50 years. And I believe the current copyright law extends beyond that. But of course, the Baker Street Irregulars were formed by Christopher Morley. And Chris was a working author. And the history of the Irregulars is bound up in looking after the author's interests and ensuring that those inventions, those memorable characters, those works are properly protected and that their ownership and invention is honored. So, you know, that does add a particular nuance to it. But the other side of it is, and I think this is the basic position that Les has taken in some of his arguments, which are all available online, that everything we know about Sherlock Holmes, the sitting room, the coal scuttle, the jackknife with the correspondence, his brother, Mycroft, Watson, his habits of deduction, his aphorisms, his view of the universe, all of that came to light in stories that preceded those few that are still, that still date back to, I think, 1927. Wasn't Casebook circa 1927?
Yeah.
And so therefore, the argument says less that these works, the character was not complete, was not fully formed, is basically specious. Now, we actually should have had less on, but his views have been well reported and covered, and I know our friends the Baker Street Babes did an interview with Les.
They did, yeah.
His arguments are well available. And we asked our friend John Lullenberg, who has long represented the interests of the Conan Doyle estate, if he would care to avail himself of a public forum to express his point of view. And he has remained mute on that invitation.
Fascinating to watch this play out and how Les has basically taken the PR offensive and really taken his case to the public. And there have been... there's been coverage on National Public Radio and the New York Times and Bloomberg and many others. Mm. And, as any institution or entity that has a case brought against it, the Conan Doyle estate is rightly staying silent at this time, as I'm sure their lawyers have advised them to do, waiting for this to play out in court. So we'll see which side actually is vindicated at the end of it. So one thing we did not do at the beginning of the show was remind people how to get in touch with us. If you have a comment, if you'd like to participate in any of the forums, you can, of course, find us at ihearofsherlock.com, where all of our content is posted and distributed. Of course, we've also got a Facebook page, I Hear of Sherlock, on Facebook there, and similarly on Twitter, I Hear of Sherlock.
But what about Tumblr? Do we have a...
We've been known to tumble
good
from
grief.
Time to time. ihearofsherlock.tumblr.com.
Amazing.
More pithy pieces of content there and looking out for what others are creating and we're resharing that on our own site. And, of course, there is a – I've refocused some effort here. Of course, the Sherlock Holmes social network had been a place where folks had congregated. Over 1,000 people signed up and were members there. Not too satisfied with the platform at this point, but what we've done is we've established a parallel universe, if you would, or if you will, over on Google Plus. There's a community over there called Sherlock Holmes. If you just go on to plus.google.com and search for Sherlock Holmes under communities, you'll find it. Everything from what's going on the web, discussion about original stories, scholarship, fan fiction, the Irregulars, of course, the Benedict Cumberbatch series, lots and lots of stuff there, and actually places to post events and to invite people to events. And this is an open forum. So if you'd like to go on there and establish a presence and show people what it is that you're doing or your local society is doing, go right ahead. It's at plus.google.com. In the community section, just search for Sherlock Holmes. And, of course, we have one of those ring-a-ma-phone things, too, don't we? The handy-dandy telephone.
You can call us at 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323. And we'd love to record your comment on that phone line, which happens automatically, and we would play it on the show. So give us a call.
And, you know, while we're talking about some of the administrative stuff here, I noted I was looking through the statistics of the show here, and one of the top referrers of traffic or of listeners is from Google Reader. Lots of people are signed up to get updates through RSS. Well, Google has announced that Google Reader is actually going away as of July 1st. And that doesn't mean the automatic updates of the show will go away unless for some reason we decide to get lazy again. but it does mean that if you rely on Google Reader as your source for finding out about updated, you need to find an alternative source. There's one called Feedly that is a good alternative. Of course, if you go on and just search for Google Reader alternatives online, you should be able to find some sort of RSS aggregator that will allow you to keep getting the show updated as regular. Of course, you can certainly subscribe by email. We encourage you to subscribe on iTunes. There should be no excuse as to why you can't find that we are updating the show. So just wanted you to be aware of that in case you are a Google Reader user.
Indeed. Well, and I guess that gets us to sort of phase two of what we wanted to talk about in Sherlockian current events, which is that the basic argument, maybe scandal is too big a word, around the concept of there being such a thing as an elite devotee. You know, who is a Sherlockian anyway?
It's an excellent question, and this isn't something that is completely modern, completely out of the, you know, the whole recent resurrection of interest in Sherlock Holmes that the BBC series or Elementary or the Robert Downey Jr. movies have had in place. This is something that I think we saw first rear its ugly head around the Jeremy Brett era, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I think that's right. Yeah.
It started with an editor's gas lamp, nonetheless, in the Baker Street Journal in, I want to say, the 1980s, late 80s, early 90s, when Phil Schreffler was the editor of the journal. And it was pretty much aimed at, you know, these new Sherlockians coming in, these people who had just discovered Sherlock Holmes. And the editorial seemed to be one that was a little disdainful of their existence, and how dare they come to this with any less than a pure form of interest, such as evidently those who have been anointed by the editor as the purists, the elite devotees, as it were. Not to be outdone, I guess Phil thought it was time to resurrect that and update it to modern times. And there's a publication that was put together called the Saturday Review of Literature.
Yeah, and it's a great shame because, yeah, you're right, that original essay was back in 1988. But the Saturday Review of Literature is terrific. This was distributed... this was offered for sale at the Baker Street Irregulars weekend this past January. It's wonderful. There are, and we'll talk a little bit more about it. There's some great, you know, the original Saturday Review of Literature had a regular column by Chris Morley in which many of the doings of the Baker Street Irregulars were first originally reported, including the doings of the 3 Hours for Lunch Club, which we have happily resuscitated in New York. And so to see it back again is wonderful, and there's some terrific content in this particular issue. But as you say, this question of the elite devotee, the original essay was reprinted and a current update provided. And it's interesting to note that this issue of the Saturday Review, this new Saturday Review of Literature, opens with Benoit Guglielmo's essay on Desmond McCarthy. Now, Desmond McCarthy wrote as under the pseudonym of Affable Hawk about Sherlockian matters decades ago in The New Statesman in the UK. And Guglielmo quotes, this is in the late 1920s, and Guglielmo quotes this description of McCarthy. He says, "His hawk was affable. There was nothing of the bird of prey about it. Its expression was friendly and benign. And a similar combination characterized his views. His judgments were acute, concerned only to discover the truth, even if this was painful or disillusioning. Yet they never seemed unduly harsh and were never scornful. And moreover, the tone in which he offered them was genial and sympathetic, quick to understand other people's point of view, and if he could, enter into them." And from my standpoint, a lot of the tragedy of this is that this elite devotee view in this particular essay has a very, very different point of view. Mm-hmm. The gulf between the Holmes fan and the devotee. And there's a lot of dwelling on these words, fan and devotee. And Philip writes, little practical difference in definitions, but a substantial difference in what they connote. And the basic landscape here is that the devotee is elite and nostalgic for the earlier days and good, and that the fan is very casual and now. And so elite refers to one's intellectual and behavioral devotion to 1895. An elite of devotees is envied. The devotee is aware of social etiquette. The devotee wears a suit and jacket, and the fan wears blue jeans and a t-shirt. Well, it's not unusual, of course, to have a nostalgia for earlier days. You know, 30 years ago, I worked for someone who would occasionally lament the loss of the era where business people wore white shirts and snap brim hats. And if he was only around today, you know, he would be tickled to see that they've all come back. But this goes beyond that. This says that the devotee is a person of language and of words, and the fan is a person of half ideas, half expressed. The devotee is genteel and dignified. Contrast that with the atmosphere of the science fiction convention. And so in the 2013 update, Philip suggests that Sherlockian fandom has entered the poorer and often internet-inspired lexicon of public discourse. The term fan is derived from fanatic. It's given rise to a culture and a subculture and jargon of its own. One of the most common examples of this being the use of con as slang and then as colloquialism. He's troubled by the conflation of Sherlockiana in the 20th century with its practice by those whose adherence to Holmes is through the BBC Sherlock and efforts like I Believe in Sherlock. And all of this is painted with a sort of contempt for contemporary technology. 140 characters in a tweet, he observes, hardly a medium for a complex idea. Well, I certainly hope that anybody who's written a haiku feels differently.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that Holmes himself would never write a letter when a telegram would suffice.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten that. And then, of course, he compares Edgar Smith's writing with an excerpt from a transcript of a Babes podcast that quotes Christina, in which she speaks with obvious enthusiasm. And Philip goes on to say, to his credit, the comparison may be unfair in the sense that Smith was writing in his typically deliberate and articulate way and Christina was speaking in an interview. But he observes, Sherlockiana ought to be a temple to wit and wisdom and grace of expression, not a potting shed on which is scrolled desultory graffiti. It would be erroneous to perceive the subversion of the best of what Sherlockiana is as being limited to those who obsess over a television series or who live their lives through the internet. And as you read this, this becomes part of a larger landscape of disaffection with the nature, or at least the perceived nature, of the BSI in the 21st century. Organized Sherlockiana is devolving. The BSI weekend has become a convention. There's this global apparatus. Books are published. There's a trust. There's an archive. This is far, he says, from the intellectual intimacy afforded to those lucky earlier elite, regular devotees. Well, this all wraps up with this sort of summary. Lightweight popular culture adds nothing. The brightest and the best is being crushed under needless complexity. And I think, you know, there you have the argument. So sort of let me stop there and get your reaction to that. Is that a fair summary of this elite devotee position?
Yeah, I think you've covered most of the main points there. It's this spirit of just derision and I think elite actually captures it quite well. And you know, here we just finished talking in a segment about Sherlock Holmes belonging to everyone, about freeing Sherlock in terms of the copyright. And yet, you know, at the same time, you've got someone saying, well, no, he really should only belong to those who have the wit and the erudition and the wardrobe. And let's think about Morley and his contemporaries. They were approaching this as new to the practice. They were establishing something and creating new experiences. Why should anyone else be exempt from that opportunity based on their level of interest or their level of fortitude?
Hmm. Well, I agree. And you know, the complexity here, and you know, part of the reason why this strikes so much to home is, I mean, look at you and I. I mean, you and I are both, I would say, very inclined to appreciate and look back to the 1930s and those early days of the Irregulars. Both sure. You and I get a lot of joy out of dressing and preparing for Sherlockian events. We enjoy that backward look, but the offensive part of it all is the us versus them.
Yeah,
you know, the black and white, the this versus that, and it all exists against a backdrop where Morley himself became disaffected with the Baker Street Irregulars, which of course began as a collection of people that he was interested in, and who were interested in him, so-called kin spirits, who could have mm-hmm. free and easy conversations. And when we get together, we enjoy that. So, you know, there is an element here of hearkening back to a simpler time, enjoying that literary environment of the 1930s, communing with people, having conversations about letters, about publishing, about writing, that we can certainly appreciate. What rubs me the wrong way is the dividing line, the signpost that says this is where it ends, that after this, nothing. You know, and what rubs me the wrong way is the dismissal of popular culture. Mm. Popular culture brought us Shakespeare in the 17th century, Beethoven in the 18th century, the Strand magazine and Beatons in the 19th century.
Exactly.
When Stravinsky premiered The Rite of Spring in Paris in 1913, he started a riot. Popular mm-hmm. culture brought us votes for women, suffragettes chaining themselves to lampposts. It brought us the civil rights movement, 45 records and long playing records. In the 1950s, popular culture brought us Dylan Thomas drinking himself to death at the White Horse Tavern. It brought us Charlie Parker and Charlie Mingus, Louis Armstrong, Fats Waller, jazz, the hula hoop, and frisbees, okay? So exactly at what point did popular culture cease to have any value? And today, you know, thanks to big advances in computing power and progress in lots of sciences and smarter networks and more powerful devices, digital technology is reshaping society. So you have the internet, but on the internet, you also have the Khan Academy teaching mathematics to mm-hmm. students all over the world. The research of scientists is now virtually instantly available to their fellows around the globe. You can today sequence the human genome in a matter of hours for thousands of dollars, not millions of dollars. And yes, at the same time, you have pictures of cats on Facebook and a good deal of silliness on Twitter. But you also have the President of the United States and the Pope on Twitter. So exactly where is the line of what's worth something and what's not?
You know, I think you're absolutely right. You know, where do you draw the line? And simply because we have this love of a character who happened to function in late Victorian, early Edwardian times, it doesn't mean we need to remain rooted in those times. Mm. There's a difference between remaining rooted in those times and having an appreciation for those times. And yes, there may be some who don't have an appreciation for those times, but still, if they have an appreciation for the character, isn't that what we long for? You know, we should be, in this day and age, when people are lamenting the lack of print publications, whether it's newspapers or books, you know, in favor of e-readers and e-books and whatnot, we should be celebrating the interest in an immortal literary character, not trying to suppress it. You know, there's room enough for everyone under this umbrella. Mm. And we should be celebrating. We should be enhancing. We should be finding places for all of these people to find common ground rather than to find the divisiveness between us and create a chasm that's even greater. And to call out poor Christina by name in that editorial was the lowest of the low. And the transcript that he mentioned, you know what? I'm sure Edgar sat in meetings and bantered with people, and it sounded like colloquial chatting. He had the time to put together. He had a secretarial pool to help him put together some of these essays and these publications. And to come down on Christina for a raw, unedited feed of a discussion on the Baker Street Babes podcast is completely unfair.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm sure he didn't intend it. But, I think we need to be careful in terms of sort of focusing on the ideas rather than the individual. But I do agree with you that there is a disturbing aspect of this, which is the element of bullying around it. You know, in any generation, the older and established generally have more power than the young and the new. Mm. So simply by having a platform, a history, a record of publishing, decades of experience in a particular specialty gives someone stature and power about which one might not themselves be objectively aware. But to use that platform to shine the light of attention on a particular individual in such a way as to make that individual the subject of scorn, that is at best thoughtless and at worst bullying. And that's one of the things that I think disturbed me most about all this. To your other point about change, you know, we have seen all this before. The electric light had a similarly revolutionary effect on society in the 1880s when the first few hundred arc lights began illuminating the streets of New York in the 1880s. One resident, a former officer of the Civil War, was so disturbed by the glare of the devil in the darkness that he never set foot out of his house again until he was carted off to the cemetery. So there are always people who resist and who are unsettled by change. That's just sort of a fact of life. But
yeah. Well, you know, I think we're very fortunate to be in the position that we are, you and I, that we're able to appreciate some of the traditions. And yes, we each do belong to one of the Sherlockian societies that is male only, but we also belong to many other societies. We don't keep company exclusively with male societies. We just take it in part of the richness of a variety of the Sherlockian experience. And yet, here we are in our sixth year of podcasting now, where we've been on the forefront of the internet and new communications with regard to Sherlock Holmes. So, you know, it's somewhat of being like the old Roman god Janus, you know, looking back while looking forward at the same time.
Well, that's very kind. You know, others would call him two-faced, but that's a very good. And by the way, it is not to, I can't decide what's more troubling: the fact that all of this is unnecessary and self-created, or its complete irrelevance to a shared enthusiasm for literary work and an immortal character.
And
what should be said is that the Saturday Review, in which this appeared, is a truly great publication. It reprints and creates Sherlockian material that's absolutely fascinating. This, the work by Benoit Guglielmo, who is from the Société Sherlock Holmes de France and the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, about Desmond McCarthy and the New Statesman, is wonderful. There's something else here. This whole issue, I don't know quite where you can find it, but if you can find it, it's worth finding. It's really by George Flesher, John Lullenberg, Don Pollock, and Philip Schreffler. And there's something magnificent in here. John Lullenberg has a great piece about the policeman who protected Chris Cella's, or Cella's speakeasy. I never know if it's Cella or Cella. But also there's a magnificent essay in here about the dynamics of an express train. And it is supposedly written by the ghost of Russell McLaughlin, BSI. But I have my suspicion as to actually who wrote it. And what it gives you in a page and a half is the experience of traveling on the New York Central's Mercury, the train of tomorrow, which began running between Detroit and Chicago in 1936. And if you were ever wondering, which I wish I had been, I never thought about it until I read this, what it must have been like for a group of Sherlockians in the 1930s to take an express train between two major cities.
Mm.
It's absolutely, absolutely magnificent.
That would have been one rocking bar car, let me tell you. Well, it looks like you can order this Saturday Review of Literature, this single issue, $5 postpaid, from Donald K. Pollock. That's P-O-L-L-O-C-K.
Oh, good.
521 College Avenue, Niagara Falls, New York, 14305. And we'll put that in the show notes as well. So if you happen to hop over to iHearOfSherlock.com on episode 51, you can find that information yourself. And we'll also have a scan of the front cover so you can see what it is that you're getting yourself into. But I would concur, Bert. I think it's a fine publication. And, you know, to read the Elite Devotee Redux there by Phil with your own two eyes and to draw your own conclusions would certainly be welcome as well. It's that time.
Yes. It must be.
Hmm?
It must be. We can retreat to our opposing corners while our seconds will bathe our temples with washcloths and... get ready for the next round.
Well, bathe yourself in this then. We have an editor's gas lamp, and this is a conscious repeat of an earlier editor's gas lamp. Interestingly enough, this was first read on episode 15. The what do you call it when things are the exact opposite? Not anagram, but palindrome.
Palindrome, very good.
Palindrome. Yeah. This is a palindrome of episode 15, when we read this very same editor's gas lamp. But I thought it was appropriate that we revisit it this time because, well, we were just talking about what makes a Sherlockian. And in this case, Edgar Smith himself in volume 3, number 2 of the old series, 1948, asked, "Who is a Baker Street irregular?" By canonical definition, a Baker Street irregular is one who, in the Sherlockian world, is prepared and equipped to, quote, go everywhere, see everything, overhear everyone, unquote. And that is a large, if somewhat technical, specification, but the source from which it derives commends it to consideration. More narrowly, a Baker Street irregular is a member in good and accepted standing of that small band of zealots which grouped itself together on one June evening in the far gone year of 1934 for the avowed and unashamed purpose of keeping green in perpetuity the name and fame of Sherlock Holmes. The solid core of that organization is composed of some 60 individuals, otherwise admittedly, if not provably sane, who spend the better part of their leisure time in activities dedicated to the propagation of the faith. And adhering to that core so closely, that distinction has become impossible, are the members of the Scion societies throughout the land, whose only peculiarity, although none but a New Yorker would regard it as such, is their residence in strange and distant provinces. More narrowly still, a Baker Street irregular is a stockholder in a minuscule corporation, separate and apart from the social organization itself, which has been created for the philanthropic purpose of defending before the law the public rights and equities of Sherlock Holmes and his attendant aura against the threats and importunities of those egregious heirs of Minstead who pretend to hold the master in patent. Of these incorporated irregulars, there are to date no more than six. But the attribution of true irregularity is not to be found in any of those categoric definitions. An irregular is, in sober fact, any kindred soul who gives spontaneously and abundantly of his time and thought in devotion to the sacred writings and to the writings about the writings, who feels his pulses quicken and his step lighter whenever, in a darkling world, he turns the corner of reality into the most magic of all streets. He is the one of that legion who cluster about the banners which Dr. Watson and his followers have raised, and who occasionally, as the spirit moves them, raise a modest banner of their own. He is a zealot in his own right, and a defender and protagonist of the zeal of others that seeks to keep alive the cause in which he shares belief. He is the kind of person, in a word, who reads the Baker Street Journal and gives it his support. That is why Ben Abramson has offered and has been empowered to offer honorary irregularity to all who subscribe to the journal. And that is why the irregulars themselves, in whatever category they may be found, extend a hand of honoring and honored welcome. Well, I think Edgar had it.
Yeah, I think as usual, yeah.
He knew this day was coming.
Well, he should have done a better job. If he knew this day was coming, then I really have a bone to pick with him. I mean, look, North Korea, come on.
Well, you know.
I rest my case.
Well, it's they say may you live in interesting times, and here we are.
Yes.
Well, you know, I've been lamenting just over the past 2 weeks or so a couple of losses of my own.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd been following a couple of issues with great interest from afar. I was on vacation a couple of weeks ago, and as I mentioned to you just before the show started, I was out in the wilderness this weekend with my sons doing some scouting activities. And there have been some things going on online that I had my eye on. And I was either too late or too cheap in my outreach. And in the one case, I'm of course talking about following Sherlockian things on eBay.
Oh.
In my own case, a couple of weeks ago, there was a run of the first volume of the new series of the BSJ, complete volumes, volume one, numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4. The green covers with the fold back pins, and I had my eye on it, and I put a bid in, and I bid pretty high, and I was outbid. This was my one and only chance to get the missing issue out of my complete BSJ collection, and I missed it because I was too cheap. And then just this evening.
Now, can one ask what that went for?
You know what? Let me take a look, because my high bid, I think, was $350, which one would think that should be plenty in terms of, you know, trying to get a single run of the BSJ, a single volume of the BSJ. I don't think I saved it on here. It went for something over $400.
Wow.
And frankly, the only issue I need is volume one, number one, new series. And I missed it. The other was just this evening. There were two copies, one from New Jersey, one from California, of... Oh, goodness gracious, now it's not coming up here either. Of something we just talked about in a recent episode, the original five letters from FDR to Edgar Smith, the pamphlet house. There were only 150 copies that Edgar made and printed. And these were two copies that were available. One went for $221, the other for $300.
Oh, $221. Wow, that's a very good price.
But each of them only had a single bid on it, and I arrived back here too late to actually do anything about it. So, unfortunately, I lost that opportunity as well.
Hmm.
But eBay is a fantastic place to look for treasures old and new regarding Sherlock Holmes. If you can't find it on eBay with regard to your particular area of interest in Sherlock Holmes, then it probably isn't available.
Hmm.
But fascinating stuff. One thing I did manage to get, which is... Yeah, somewhat Sherlockian in nature, although nothing specifically mentioned, is I got a student lamp.
Oh, really? An original?
Familiar with student lamps?
Sure. You mean an actual original one with that can accept some liquid fuel in there?
Well, interestingly enough, this is a double student lamp. So you've seen the one arm with the, you know, the green globe covering the hurricane lamp. This is a double, so there's one coming out of each side. And it is an old kerosene version that was, it looks like sometime in the 1930s or 40s, converted to electric. And it's got the original cloth cord coming out of it after the conversion. So I do need to replace one of the electric switches in it because it's not functioning currently. But it's got all the knobs and the original... hardware with regard to running it as a kerosene lamp.
Oh, so that's great.
Beautiful. And
wow.
It's big, too. I didn't realize exactly how big it was going to be.
And is that something you got on eBay?
It was on eBay,
yeah. Oh, good for you.
So, and I'm sure you can find tantaluses or tantali, as they are, or gasogenes or other things to add to your own Sherlockian collection. So take a look out there.
Well, I've never been a real, I have a lot of stuff, obviously, but I've never been I've never been someone who's gone after particular things, but I can admire that. I mean, the student lamp sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, once I get it working, it'll actually be functional. You know, I needed a good light for one corner of my office, and I thought, well, why not do some, and it, what's interesting is it's right next to my podcasting equipment. So, you know, there's Janice right there on my desk looking back and looking forward. I like that kind of divide of interest. In my office at Ford, I actually keep a what looks like a humidor, but it's where I store my fountain pens. And, you know, people walk into the social media guy's office and a pen storage container on the desk. So,
well, but, you know, there's a lot of that's very interesting. You should say that. I mean, the fountain pen is a oddly enough has echoes, I think, to our earlier conversation. Well, I mean, I'm a little hazy now in the early history, but Louis Waterman received a patent for the fountain pen sometime in the late 19th century. And obviously that has been superseded by ballpoints in the 1940s, by Bic pens and pencils and recording devices and smartphones and keyboards and computers. And yet fountain pens are still manufactured and some people enjoy writing with them. In fact, some people pay very large sums for special editions of fountain pens. You know, there's never been, to my knowledge, a Conan Doyle. No, there was a pen. I think Krone,
yes.
Krone made a Study in Scarlet pen, or Krone, however you pronounce their name. And Mont Blanc made an Agatha Christie pen, of course.
And there was a speckled band pen, I think, once too, of the snake.
There have been a number of snake pens. That motif was very popular in the 20s. But amazingly enough, the world seems to chug along at such a rate as people who enjoy those sorts of things can still buy them and use them and get a lot of enjoyment out of them. And as near as I know, no one's ever taken the position that folks who do that occupy a special status, are more worthy of regard than folks who write with the plain old number two pencil. And that's underpins the idea that the answer to the question of who is a Sherlockian anyway is everybody.
I think that's a great parallel. And who knows what other aspects of life that can lend themselves to that kind of argument as well. I think this is part of the notion of humans evolving and having a consciousness of things that have gone before and a desire to cling to the past. But you know what? The absolute need to evolve with the times. And I don't think it's a sentiment or an argument that will necessarily go away and nor that will be resolved anytime soon.
Well, you know, it's not to prolong it past all interest, but I think it's more than, you know, the need to stay pace with the times. I mean, there's a lot of research that indicates that having a community, being part of a community, being part of discussions, speaking with other people, exchanging ideas is fundamental to happiness. And the saddest thing is to outlive your community, you know, to find yourself in your 10th or 11th decade as the last of your generation. And one of the tricks, I think, as the population ages, to maintain a sense of happiness is to cultivate and build relationships with generations that come after you, so that by the time you get into your 10th or 11th decade, you're not the only one left, you know, that there are other people who are still interested in talking with you and that you still have relationships that are enduring. And that just seems to me to be fundamental to where society is going and to where something basic in terms of personal happiness really is.
Yeah, I would totally agree there. And, of course, we've made it practically the whole run of the show here without mentioning our sponsors other than the opening. And what about the Baker Street Journal? Well, that's a testament. That is a monument to what has gone before us, and yet it still keeps chugging along. I think we've seen since 1945, the publication itself has, well, not necessarily really changed too much over time, but has kept going and has adapted to the world around it. Certainly has an online presence at bakerstreetjournal.com, but it is the premier publication of Sherlockian scholarship, and it does have all those things in it, from the editorials, the gas lamps, now that Steve Rothman puts together as part of his editorship. It has visuals, cartoons. Basil Chapp has joined the ranks of the illustrators at the Baker Street Journal, along with Scott Bond, who's been a long-term cartoonist and artist in residence for the Baker Street Journal. But the scholarship itself keeps going on. There's always a new angle to the things of old, and people are bringing their interest to it time and time again. So it is a fascinating publication to read to.
Mm. Hear, hear.
And of course, our friends at West Express that kind of chronicle all of this stuff, from the Sherlock Holmes Reference Library to some of the newer publications, Occasionally to Embellish, which Nick Utekin put together. It was an anthology of some of his old writings, all under one set of covers, and an in-depth look at the greatest literary partnership in history, the Strand Magazine, looking at Conan Doyle and Greenhouse Smith. Fantastic kind of recounting there of Sherlock Holmes as he appeared in the Strand Magazine. That and much, much more available at wessexpress.com.
Mm-hmm. Well, I believe we've done it again.
We have barely done it again, but we've done it.
I suppose that leaves me with nothing to say except I'm Bert Wolder.
And that must mean I am Scott Monty.
And the game's afoot.
Game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.